Like the buffet at a Pizza Hut, please don't desert me. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, proudly brought to you through GorillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's alternative media. I have a very special guest for you, ladies and gentlemen, someone of prestige and allegedly genius capacity for mathematics. Now, mathematics, as we all know, is the base structure for absolutely everything. Everything's built on math upon math upon math. It is everything. But, interestingly enough, what's been happening later on in the piece, in the economy, and economic planning, hasn't involved a chief amount of mathematics at all. Instead, it has been relying primarily on dogmatics, as in New World Order, we want to enslave the entire world, and make them all bankrupt so that we'll be the only rich bastards left, kind of New World Order. However, there is a solution, conveniently enough. And my very special guest, Mike Montagne, or Montagne, is it?
Better said the second time there. Yeah, pretty good. I always I've been telling people since I was 5 years old that it's French. It means jerk.
I'll believe that. Now,
I used to have a lot of fun. Some people wouldn't laugh. Some would, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is the thing. If you're going to be dealing with a subject as very, very serious and deadly as economics can be, you best be able to laugh to keep your sense of humor.
A little bit, at least, yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, you'd just go freaking crazy.
Which might be my problem now, Vince.
Well, you know, there is a tipping point. You know, there's a tipping point.
Besides, you know? I'm American, you remember, so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the predisposed insanity. I mean, if you're born in America, obviously insane.
Well, we do have our issues over here. There is no doubt, at least amongst a few of us. But saying loudly in the bar is not, you know, always the best idea, but anyway, where do we
just
begin?
Start chanting USA, USA, USA after it, and I'm sure everybody will join in.
You know, I'm sorry. It just nationalism is when you're wrong in so many ways, especially as you know, what gave Hitler the green light. You know.
Yeah. Supporting something wrong for the right reasons is just as bad as doing something bad for the wrong reasons. You know, because
in truth it is, and in a purportedly free world, that's giving up the only way to freedom. You know, no matter who you read or study or have listened to, if there's anybody much to listen to about, you know, true patriotism, patriotism's not to a country, it's to a principle. The country is founded on the principle, hopefully, which is what, you know, how the United States began. But if you're not adhering to those principles any longer, I'm sorry. You know, USA, USA, USA. No, that's like saying, I'm stupid, I'm stupid, I'm stupid, you know.
Or I would say it, I'm gullible, I'm gullible, I'm gullible.
Yeah, or worse, much worse, you know. Gullible and ready to kill for it, too, you know. So,
man, just such a... Imagine the mindset that's been placed there, and more importantly, the minds who would have wanted it to be there in the first place. Think about the insanity. Somebody who's so stupid that they'll kill somebody else for something that they know nothing about but believe in so strongly that it's worth taking somebody else's life and dying for.
Yeah, or believe that they're doing it for one reason when, in fact, they're put there to do it for other reasons. and, you know, as you just said moments ago, doing something, you know, wrong for the wrong reasons is just as bad as doing something right for the wrong reasons. It depends on what, of course, you're doing, but the worst things are done for either, which are both wrong.
It's kind of like when you take the shepherding atmosphere, like, oh, the people are too stupid to think for themselves, you know? They're savages. They'll tear each other apart without us controlling them, you know? It's for their own good. Look, there's too many of them. Life is just too difficult, you know? We want to sustain everybody. So let's exterminate most of them and just come the rest, okay? The rest will just serve us forever in perpetuity, all right? That's the kind of society we want. And it'll be what's best for everybody.
Well, yeah, when there's four fish left in the stream and 400 people fishing for them, it's time to recognize you messed up.
Yeah. Now, speaking of which, we have very limited time and there's a limited amount of knowledge that somebody can gain while on this earth. So, best thing to do is to try and spend your time seeking out the best knowledge available. The mathematically perfected economy. Currently, the economy is one of the most powerful instruments in our modern life. It affects everything we do in every single way. And one would have to be quite foolish to believe the mainstream media puppets reporting that everything's just turning around and going quite swimmingly. However, apparently, back in the day, there were people who wished to have an economy that worked and worked for everybody. But they've since forgotten about it and pushed in the other direction.
I personally don't think anyone quite got to that economy that served us all. There were many men in our history of our country at its founding, at least, who were pointed that direction. But in the midst of a revolution, monetary solution is, you know, it's not the thing that dawns on you suddenly when you're ducking bullets and loud explosions are going off all around you. And, you know, you're hearing the screams of the dying and all, and, the founders, no matter who you cite of the best minds of all, Franklin, Jefferson, probably the two foremost of the founding of our country, both were very much pointed at a perfection of economy. But they really didn't have even a complete foundation to begin with, and so it's not right for us to say that you know, that we've forgotten a science of money. Largely through all history, what's happened is the best seers amongst us at that time pointed out that there were flaws in economy, and many people today, sadly, somehow think, if we could use that word so poorly, presume would be a better word, that there's no such thing as a possibility even of solving our monetary issues, but when you go back and look at the work of Benjamin Franklin, for instance, he wrote a paper when he was 23. A good deal of it is alleged to be plagiarism. But nonetheless, it postulates some of the most important questions we all need to ask, and largely the title of the paper that I'm referring to is A Modest Inquiry, and he spells it, or they spelled it in those days, with an E instead of an I, A Modest Inquiry into the Nature and Necessity of a Paper Currency. And basically, this paper just postulates that, it observes that when they issued paper money beyond the very restricted gold and silver coin that they had available to them at the time, I'm hoping my computer didn't go to sleep. Are you still hearing me?
Yeah, man.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, screen went black and everything. Okay. I'm sorry to the audience, too. Excuse me. I thought I might have to be...
Well, quit saying you're sorry and keep going.
Okay, I'll do that. He observes that they enjoyed far greater prosperity when they issued paper money beyond what gold and silver reserves they had. And it doesn't take a lot of thinking to realize why, but we don't know that the answer that we come to would be absolutely why without a tremendous amount of further examination. But the reason why, and I'm just going to give it to us right now at this point, is that if there isn't so much circulation as effectively represents at least the value of all things, then someone has been deprived of reward for it. Now, we can also examine that there are problems. If, for instance, we attempted to exchange all of our production all at once, it would be impossible because there isn't enough money to represent it. But these are the kinds of observations which concur with what Franklin was laying out in this paper, A Modest Inquiry into the Nature and Necessity of a Paper Currency, where he observes that they enjoyed far more prosperity for issuing paper currency in addition to the gold and silver that they had circulating, which was a very modest quantity. He further postulates that some amount of paper would be too much, and some would be not enough. But there are only a few questions that we actually have to ask in order to determine exactly how much currency must be in circulation. And in fact, I just gave the clue to the answer to this riddle, which sounds at first like something that, somebody could just say that and it seems like it's right, but how do we know it? And in fact, as we were implying earlier with our other remarks, in fact, any country which is a republic only preserves representation if indeed it understands its issues. So we do have to understand these issues, or in fact we find, as has been the case throughout history, that government is the most powerful tool of exploitation. And usually, if we each of us examine history, and even in a primitive way, we see that in fact, when you get to the bottom or even near the bottom of practically any story in history, in truth, whatever went on was for the sake of exploitation. And if we rid this from our lives, most of the wars that have been fought would never be fought. Most of the denials of freedom and oppression that's ever existed would never have existed. And so it's very important, to at least give leeway to the possibility that there is a monetary prescription which can eradicate all these tremendous evils from the world. But my introduction to this is a good course to break into that, because we can understand what's really gone wrong with the world from the perspective that I raised in 1968 in a high school economics class. I had a very advanced education in mathematics as a very young child, and mathematics was just not something that you could pull the wool over my eyes, especially in a very rudimentary or elementary level. And mind you, now we're not throwing out any challenging math at all. We're talking about second grade arithmetic that all people can understand what's wrong with the lie of economy by second grade arithmetic. But in order to do so, we have to be willing to re-examine some very wrong ideas that many of us hold. Like when I explain this story, people will ask, well, who would loan us money if it wasn't subject to interest? Well, in fact, you're not borrowing money from a banking system. You're allowing a banking system merely to publish evidence of our promissory obligations to each other. So the idea that we have to borrow money from a banking system is preposterous, in effect. But we'll explain that shortly down the road. I only mention it now because...
borrowing money from a bank for a government is like paying somebody for your air that you can just breathe in by for free anyway.
Yes, it, in a way it might be said to be analogous to that or anything else we might conjure up. But specifically what it is say, for instance, you built a $100,000 house, a house that you wanted $100,000, an abstract unit, and but yet which you'd gauged in your work to.
Unfortunately, we don't have time, Mike, for that story. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with more very, very naughty stuff that the bankers have been up to and how to beat them. The way it's going to be. Oh, yes. Another beautiful day in the island slave chain of New Zealand. My very special guest, Mike Montagna. joins us all the way over from the fabulous USSA.
Yeah, the up under, we call it. Anyway, I guess I was telling this story that is kind of the story about how I saw all this all of a sudden. Now, of course, I've been seeing it in many ways up to that time, but I'm only about 16 years old. Just have an awful lot of math education under my belt, and there's a thing that's wrong.
Pardon? I kind of wanted to perfect economics. Didn't you? You told me once that when you went into mathematics school or something, you told the teacher they were wrong or something?
Yeah, that's this story, actually, that I was about to tell. And basically what happens is I get thrown in this economics class, which is far below my usual curriculum. And the first thing is that I'm appalled. I had a way of learning because I was actually thrown into college algebra classes at such a young age and had to learn myself that I had to develop my own ways of teaching myself or learning. Get into the bottom of the issues. And the first thing I did is I would browse through a whole college textbook and maybe several times in an evening, they go all the way to the end, halfway through it, a quarter way through it, you know, several times through the first three chapters, you know, once again through the first two chapters, twice through the first chapter, and all of a sudden I see where it's starting, where it's going, how it's put together, how the whole thing flows, the direction it's taking us. And that makes it just so much easier to learn. You don't have to understand all these things at first, but you do need to see what they're made of. And the thing is I get thrown into this economics class, and the book is just as big as any, you know, semester or college textbook that I'd seen, and, you know, for many years before. You know, I've been basically doing college math for 10 years and proving things like the Pythagorean theorem off the top of my head. So this is a class that's far beneath my usual curriculum, and I get the textbook and I go to the end and there isn't a single theorem in it. And what people have to understand, many of you, probably all of us who have much of an education know, but a theorem is a proof. In other words, if we say that the sum of the squares of the sides of the right triangle equal the square of the hypotenuse, we don't just say that. There's an actual proof of it. And in fact, there are many different proofs, many ways of proving it. So the thing about this economics textbook is there wasn't a single proof in its entirety. In fact, the pseudoscience we call economics is entirely bereft of formal proof and theorem. And in fact, one day, soon I hope, we'll all realize that is one of the greatest deceptions and facades and ruses which was ever perpetrated on mankind for thousands of years. But anyway, I'm in this class, and I'm a polite student, but there's two things that we call learning. One is not learning. We call it learning, and that is when someone tells us something, we just assimilate it, not in terms of digging down to its roots, examining whether or not it is actually true. But if somebody teaches us that circulatory inflation causes price inflation, we just memorize that and go on, and one day we're an economist. Well, in fact, we've just swallowed a lie, and the fact that we pursued the facade of being an economist throughout our education is a proof, in truth, that we have no credibility at all. And I'm about to explain why, and this amounts to an explanation that this lie of economy is in fact terminal. It can only go on so long until it dispossesses everyone of their production and becomes defeasant. All industry is destroyed so that it can never operate it again unless we artificially re-establish or re-allow creditworthiness, whereas creditworthiness has been destroyed by a multiplication of artificial indebtedness into terminal sums of artificial indebtedness to people who merely publish evidence of promissory, of our promissory obligations to each other. And this is the important thing. It's just like a college textbook. You don't have to understand that the first time you hear it. What you need to do is listen carefully so that you can understand it as it is explained. So here I am in this economics class, and the teacher teaches us the definitions of the terms inflation and deflation, which are often mistakenly taken to mean multiple things, which in fact conflict with each other or do not concur with each other. In any case, the traditional definitions of inflation and deflation correspond to the terms that I've given since as circulatory inflation and deflation, each being respectively increases or decreases in circulation per represented wealth. In other words, if you have a $100,000 house, brand new, there should be $100,000 in circulation relative to the house to sustain the commerce and industry relative to that house. And so the teacher gives the traditional definitions of inflation and deflation as increases or decreases in circulation per represented property or value of represented property, and then immediately asserts, on the very heels of saying so, after the period, he says that he asserts that circulatory inflation causes price inflations. That inflation, that is, an increase in circulation per represented wealth, causes prices to go up. In other words, this preposterous assertion is supposedly explains that prices go up when more money goes into circulation, rather than us producing two $100,000 houses for $200,000 being in circulation, the prices of homes go up to $200,000, which is preposterous enough in itself. But is it even possible for the circulation to do this? In fact, he's taught a rule before this, which means that it's impossible to suffer circulatory inflation. And you apply this rule to the assertions of Ron Paul and his supporters, for instance, and you see that indeed there is no circulatory inflation. And in fact, you cannot attribute our problems to circulatory inflation as Ron Paul and his supporters do without qualification. There's no scientific basis for it. He just says so. Okay. And this is very important for us to distinguish this, because otherwise we can never understand these issues. So as soon as this teacher says that circulatory inflation causes price inflation in the traditional terms and explanations of the time, my hand shot into the air without hesitation. I had enough because, to be frank, this is just obvious bullshit. Everyone listening should realize that it's not even possibly true. But how? I said, first of all, Mr. Otto, you've taught that money comes into a circulation as a debt subject to interest, and that the debts are collateralized. And he's nodding his head, yes. And I said, therefore, how is it even possible to suffer circulatory inflation? And he just stood there, dumbfounded. His mouth opened. He turned red in the face. He realized, because I have a reputation of, you know, I'm a young kid, but I can prove the Pythagorean theorem right off the top of my head to this very day. And he realized he was in a corner, and he thought about it. And finally he said, by God, I think you're right. And I said, furthermore, even if we could suffer this circulatory inflation, which is mathematically impossible to suffer if we collateralize debts, in other words, I'm saying between the lines that we don't even suffer circulatory inflation, you dumb bastard, you know? And anyway, so I said, Second of all, even if we suffered this circulatory inflation, which is mathematically impossible to suffer, if you merely collateralize debts, being as this money comes into circulation as a debt subject to interest, this would comprise an implicit obligation to pay principal and interest out of a circulation which at any time would be comprised itself of only some, no more than some, remaining principal. And so, in order to persist in servicing the initial obligations, you would have to borrow principal back into circulation and interest as well, in order to maintain this vital circulation, which is necessary to maintain, to persist in servicing these debts. So then, what principal you're paying out of circulation has to be reborrowed as a new debt equal to the old, making it mathematically impossible, therefore, to pay down the sum of debt. Worse, what interest you're paying out of circulation, being as it counted none against the former sum of debt, and being as it can only be borrowed back into circulation as new debt above the former sum of debt, therefore increases the sum of artificial indebtedness by so much as periodic interest on an ever greater sum of debt until, of course, eventually we suffer a terminal sum of debt which consumes the entire circulation in servicing it, leaving nothing whatever to sustain the industry which is obligated to do so. So I've just said in this much of my question, my rhetorical question, I've proven that this lie that we call economy is terminal. And I say furthermore, however, all the while, evermore of the circulation is dedicated to servicing this escalating sum of artificial debt. Therefore, leaving Everless for markets to afford the rising prices that industry has to charge in order to maintain margins of solubility. Therefore, how is it even possible to sustain these increasing prices? And indeed, they're not attributable to an increase in circulation per goods and services or represented wealth as you've defined it. On the contrary, they're attributable instead to the fact of this multiplication of artificial indebtedness into terminal artificial indebtedness and ultimate failure of the entire system. So he stood there, blank-faced, still red as embarrassed as he was from my first question, the first part of my question. And he thought even longer this time, and he finally says, "By God, I think you're right again." And this is a very serious thing to contemplate, because what we have before us is an obfuscation of the currency. Do we borrow money from banks? Do you know, if that were the case, all the money that exists always existed. That's a hard thing for people to understand, but an easier thing to understand is that this is what happens. All money comes into circulation when one of us, or however many of us, go to a bank and we sign a contract to assume a promissory obligation, a debt. All the banking system does is publish evidence of that contract. That's what we call money. And this is the process of monetization. Now, there's nothing wrong with publishing the evidence of the promissory obligation and using that as currency. There is nothing wrong with the fact that this is a debt. After all, if you've built this $100,000 home with a 100-year lifespan, and I want to buy it from you, and I issue you my promissory obligation, the reason for a uniform currency is so that we can all accept it. We can recognize that we have $100 of that $100,000 or whatever, because it's been issued by a legitimate, certified process in a legitimate form. The problem is you, the builder of the home, or the real creditor, you've been paid in full, and that's right, too. This is an advantage of true credit, but you're the real creditor. You're the person who gives up property in exchange for this promissory obligation. You are the one who is the creditor, and you are paid in full by this issuance of a promissory obligation to you, so long as the integrity of the promissory obligation is maintained, which means you can spend across the economy a representation
of your worth. And, it's hard to get your head around a false economy, because we've been brought up with such lies. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we'll be right back after this little break. Welcome back. Mike Montagna is my guest. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. My very special guest, Mike Montagna, welcome back. Now, I apologize first off to the affiliates for the usage of the properly pronounced as BS on FCC regulated radio. Because apparently, you know, FCC complaints can do a lot of damage, but it doesn't matter. Let's continue on.
All right,
the mathematically perfect economy. The mathematically perfect economy. Continue.
Well, we're talking about just what's wrong with it, and with the present system, which is imposed upon us. None of us have given our assent to any principles which are proven, and which are proven or justified to serve us. And this is the issue. Is does this system serve us? And in fact, it's a preposterous, that in fact, it's one of the most preposterous methods of stealing from people that's ever been conceived. It's existed for thousands of years. And in fact, it imposes terminal dispossession, short way into a minimal lifespan. And so it's very important for us to understand this process of terminal failure because, of course, if we're going to solve this issue, we have to understand exactly what it is and then alone can we understand how to solve it. So anyway, the issue here is that when we issue a promissory obligation, the creditor is paid in full, and what we call the debtor, who I prefer to call the obligor, the debtor or obligor, their obligation is yet to pay off this obligation. And if they do so, and if and only if they do so at the rate of consumption or depreciation of the related property, do we maintain the integrity of the circulation? It's of interest both to the obligor and to the creditor, the real creditor. The banks are not real creditors. It's of interest to both to maintain the integrity of the currency. Why? Because if the value of the currency goes up or down, deviates at all, one or the other is injured. Now, and of course, the original obligation was to pay $100,000 worth of the obligor's production for $100,000 of the creditor's production. So the way that we maintain this integrity of the currency is by eradicating interest, which solves this cause of terminal failure, and by paying and retiring the principal at the rate of consumption or depreciation of the related property. What does that mean? That means that you pay for the $100,000 house as you consume of it. You pay $100,000 overall, and you pay that $100,000 as you consume of it. This and this alone maintains a circulation which is always equal to the remaining value of the home and the remaining obligation to pay just that for the remaining value of the home, which is yet to be consumed. So this is the only way of solving inflation and deflation is to maintain, of course, this is why it comes back to second grade math. You know, when you define something as an increase or a decrease, two things is increases or decreases in relation to another thing. And of course, the only way to solve the increases or decreases in relation to the other thing is to maintain an equality to the other thing, which means to solve inflation and deflation. Obviously, you maintain a circulation which at all times is equal to the represented wealth, which means that it has to be equal to the remaining value of the represented wealth. And of course, as we've just shown, there is even one and one only way to do that, which is to pay and to retire principal at the rate of consumption or depreciation of the represented property. So what's wrong with the banking system then is we have somebody who just comes into this, intervenes upon this relationship between an obligor, who we call a debtor. They're not a debtor because they're not really borrowing money from a bank. The bank doesn't give up any money. They just publish the evidence of our promissory obligations to each other. So what happens is the banking system intervenes upon every such relationship and merely writes out on their paper, they say, no, Mike, you can't issue Vincent your promissory obligation on your paper. It has to be issued on our paper, not the people's paper, our paper, private entities who are going to exploit a live economy to dispossess us. And so all they do is issue the evidence of my promissory obligation. becoming the entity which accepts the principle, but the principle isn't their property. They never gave up any lawful consideration equal to the asserted debt. In fact, on average across the world, it costs approximately $2 to issue $100,000 into circulation. So the real costs and risks of the banking system are about $2 per $100,000 of physical money that's issued, and only a fraction, of course, of the circulation is actually issued in physical money, but that's the most cost that they can incur. So for a cost of $2 of the paper to issue $100,000 into circulation, when we pay the principal, they just take possession of it as if they had loaned it, but they didn't loan it to us. They just published the evidence of our promissory obligation. So their first crime is that they launder all the principal that's ever issued in this way into their possession. So they actually artificially enriching the banking system then by the first part of the obfuscation, so much as the value of all things which are ever financed in this way, and basically all things have to be financed this way in the end of the system at least, because everything has to be financed to continue to the last moment, possible moment of the system, borrowing this interest and principal back into circulation. Everything ends up being financed in the end. The second part of the crime then is this terminal issue, and that is that when we have to borrow principal and interest back into circulation to maintain a vital circulation, the sum of artificial indebtedness increases at an ever escalating rate until eventually all of the money in circulation is dedicated to servicing debt. None of it is available to sustain industry, and in fact industry fails even before such a moment because industry has minimal costs of sustaining it. So, in truth, that's the issue. We have terminal failure and we have laundering of the principal into the banking system, with the cause of terminal failure being this implicit obligation to maintain a vital circulation so that we can continue servicing any initial obfuscations of promissory obligations until we suffer terminal failure. So it's as simple as that. Those are the problems. How do we solve them? It took me a long time to, several months after I went home from this day of school, and I realized, well, okay, so what would be the mathematic solution of these issues? And obviously, my rhetorical questions to my teacher implied that there is one and one only solution to inflation and deflation, that being to maintain a circulation which is at all times equal to represented wealth or property. There would be one and one only solution, obviously, to inherent, irreversible, and therefore terminal multiplication of artificial indebtedness by interest. And, of course, that is simply eradication of interest, which the banking system doesn't deserve. It is not justified. They paid $2 to issue $100,000 of evidence of our promissory obligations, which are obligations to each other. They don't even involve the banking system. By accepting a banking system, we've basically just decided somehow that there can only be this one publisher of evidence of our debts, and that they're owed to that publisher, that much is owed to the publisher rather than the cost that they suffer to publish the evidence. So, you know, there's a huge disparity in the math, and it's a lie. You're not borrowing money from a bank. They're just issuing evidence of our promissory obligations to each other, and this is in fact terminal. So it is mathematically perfected economy. It solves inflation and deflation by an obligatory schedule, by eradicating interest and an obligatory schedule of payment at the rate of consumption or depreciation of the related property. There is no other solution for inflation and deflation. So you know there is no other monetary solution other than what I'm, prescribing right now, other than mathematically perfected economy, just from the solution of inflation and deflation. The third category, I give three categoric faults of all prospective monetary theses. I'm going to give the third one now, this being inherent, irreversible, and therefore terminal multiplication of artificial indebtedness by interest. The only solution of that is eradication of interest. Now, The third categoric fault took me some time to realize, and that is, what about all the other things that could be wrong with this lie of economy? And I suddenly realized that there's a pattern.
There is a pattern to it all, and we'll get more into more of this after the break. We're talking about the mathematically perfected economy. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, TNS Radio in Ireland, and also quite a number of other AM affiliates around the world. And we'll be right back after this very short break.
Women and children, front line, lock on, tune in, stand and be counted, wounded, stationed in the belly of the vulture, watch your back, there's no civilians, women, children, front line, listen, consider this a distant, early warning, the fire's imminent, pollution, gathering dust, particles, funneling through smokestacks, airwaves, bandwidth, disinformation, too fed, check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.
Gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, it's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on American Freedom Radio, and giving a shout out to TNS Radio in Ireland and iFinity FM in Invercargill, and to a lesser extent, Rush FM in Hamilton, which, as many of you may know, got closed down by the government. And I wish I could claim responsibility for that, but life is just not that cruel, apparently. My very special guest is Mike Montagna, the creator of the mathematically perfect economy. Now, let's continue on. One thing I wanted to do was actually define what an economy actually is, because all these politicians, they keep going, we've got to grow the economy, we've got to do this, something tells me that they couldn't even define the word, let alone plan one.
That's true. In fact, growth is a very ambiguous term, as they use it, and so are many other terms, like unemployment. Unemployment is a huge lie. Here, the way they keep the statistics, you're only unemployed so long as you're receiving unemployment benefits. And they only grant you the benefits, quote-unquote benefits, which is basically a license to suffer the consequences of their obfuscation of the currency and be reimbursed to a very small degree for losses incurred for a very short while. But anyway, when someone falls off the unemployment rolls, they're no longer considered unemployed. So when they say, you know, or when you hear that Ben Bernanke is citing some slight increase in the, you know, employment as a reason to believe that the first quarter's recovery is promising. Actually, if you do the least
study of his own data or even his own presentations, you quickly discover that, you know, what's happened is, first of all, we've got closer to 30% unemployment, and they're calling it, let's just say, 10% unemployment. And now it's gone down to 9.75%. And according to the way they keep the figures, but the reason that it's gone down a quarter of a percent, which is of what's already a terribly watered down lie, the reason that it's gone down is that they're just not accounting for that person as being unemployed anymore. So what real reason do they believe that, do they have to believe that there's a recovery? The other thing is, how can you possibly have a recovery if, in fact, this obfuscation of the currency can only multiply artificial indebtedness? So all being as we've already reached a terminal sum of artificial indebtedness, and the obfuscation can only increase the indebtedness further in proportion to a circulation or remaining capacity to service debt, that means that you can only artificially sustain the lifespan, while in fact the conditions get worse and more potent to manifesting in terminal failure and complete dispossession when your methods of artificially sustaining the lie ultimately fail. And they too have finite lifespans. So the longer we hear this lie, thinking, oh, we hope these guys that don't serve us are somehow right, and yet there's no reason to believe that they're right. I mean, you know, right now it's basically happening over here as we're banking on a quarter of a percent decrease in the employment rate, and you can just take a drive anywhere around the country you want, and you see there's more, you know, empty office and industrial space than ever before. You go from town to town to town to town in this country. And what's the employment? It's all dedicated to, most of it is government, forestry, road maintenance, private might be limited to one hospital. And there's just no industry in this huge area that I'm in right at this very moment, you know, and it's, you know, to say that it's striking is a huge understatement. But that we don't pull our heads out of the sand and say, oh, wait a minute, you know, I mean, I've been advocating mathematically perfected economy for over 40 years, and
Let's talk about that. You've been doing it a long time, which would suggest to me that the idea would probably be puppeted, purported, or be out there in major influential circles. I mean, how many people would we be able to point a stick at and say, ah, yep, that's mathematically perfected economy they're trying to talk about there?
Actually, there's a huge number. I mean, if you go
just throw out some top names.
Well, somebody had an ongoing argument with over the last few days here. Roger Hayes is forming a thing he calls Lawful Bank. Stephen Zarlinga, Ellen Hodgson Brown, Bill Still, Jacques Jacquarin, they've all plagiarized my work, at least to one degree, and that is to assume that the faults of interest are understood and need to be resolved without citing the reasons. You can't just say that it's a Ponzi scheme. Ellen Hodgson Brown has argued with me in online debates that interest isn't even the issue. Now she's come full circle, and she's advocating that money has to be spent into circulation. Numbers of people, just to give you an example, a few years ago, you know, I'd done an essay on on Franklin's essay, Nature and Necessity of a Paper Currency, and I basically tore it apart, showing how Franklin only had to ask a couple of questions. Whenever somebody penetrates to the root of an issue, as is necessary to develop a solution, there isn't really any trick to it at all. It's a matter of asking the questions that lead to the answer. So there isn't any dumb question. But there are more marvelous questions. And I'd written this essay to show how little Franklin had to go to change his essay completely from saying, well, if we issued too much paper currency, maybe that would have been damaging, you know, and maybe not enough wouldn't have been as beneficial as, you know, whatever is just right. Well, we can figure out exactly what is just right. But in any case, just as an example, you know, I've written about that essay many times, but I did so just 3 years ago or so. And what happened? When I did so, I've got all these extensive records, millions of files, and I have a copy of the, you know, paper as it's posted at the University of Virginia, but it's on a Windows system, and I'm working on OS 10 at the moment. And, you know, instead of, you know, booting another system and digging through my stuff over there to get it, I just repeat this search, you know, or do a search, and I pulled this paper off, you know, the University of Virginia site again, you know, just 3 years ago or so, and there was like 12. Was a relatively unknown paper. It's mentioned not only here in my work, but in an earlier thing that I did. Since 1975, I published an essay, which I call Parable of Perfect Economy, in which the resolutions of true economy, which I developed, even when I was just 16, are issued through the fictional mouth of Benjamin Franklin. And so just, I don't know what it was, within about a year now, somebody had reason for me to provide substantial further written explanation in regard to my other article, and I was in the exact same situation again. And so I did a search on Google again to just grab that paper again from the University of Virginia. And instead of getting 12 results, I got 25,400,000. And from the very first of them, right on through, I do the 100 results per page thing. And right down through the first page, you have site after site after site after site asserting that Benjamin Franklin had prescribed this perfected economy. Now, all these people have this mistaken idea because when Jacques Jacquerin plagiarized my work in, it was 1994 or 5, in his so-called Debt Virus, he actually wrote me before he wrote it, and he had some questions, and I didn't think too much of the fellow, and never heard from him until all of a sudden there he is, author of this book, which is my thesis of inevitable failure, poorly explained failure. The solution is he's just watched that so bad you wouldn't even know if it was presented. And this is the same thing with, for instance, Money is Debt. But just in regard to my work on that one paper, one essay that I wrote, you know, you have 25,400,000 pages pretending all of a sudden to offer similar, you know, assessments of it. And, you know, people who do these things don't realize that, you know, my work isn't a matter of opinion. I'm not offering my opinion or my feelings or my sentiments or what someone else taught in history. I'm offering just the bare mathematic facts expressed in literal terms as they relate to life, economy, industry, commerce, simple as that. Money is dead is another example, and I did a program on it last week. Well, money is dead is a preposterous thing. I've just explained this terminal obfuscation of the currency, for instance, so your audience can hopefully appreciate my reaction to money as debt is that it's just a preposterous misunderstanding. Is debt the offense or injury to us? Absolutely not. For instance, if you build this $100,000 home and I pay you $100,000 for it by issuing a promissory obligation to you, and that obligation being as you can spend, you're paid in full, the currency, I'm obligated to pay it out of circulation. It's not the property of anyone. It isn't owed to the publisher. The publisher never gave up $100,000. And so this idea of money is debt is the issue, and it's just hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people are, I hear about it several times a day that it's the authoritative work. And all it is a plagiarism of my work, which jumps to the wrong conclusion at the most basic fundamental level. Because debt is not an injury. If I pay $100,000 for a $100,000 house, it doesn't matter if I pay cash for it or if I assume a promissory obligation, I'm paying for the house with an equal measure of my own work. It's interest that's the problem. Money is dead is not an issue. If we quit issuing money as debt, this would prevent a newlywed couple, for instance, from buying a $100,000 home with a 100-year lifespan under mathematically perfected economy. Here's the thing. If we allow them to pay for it as they consume of it, what are the costs? If we divide the 100-year lifespan into a $100,000 principal, the cost of that home under mathematically perfected economy is $1,000 a year or $83.33 a month. Approximately across the world in general, 1/12 of what we pay for that home under the obfuscation of the currency, which that couple can't afford. But what newlywed couple that's even part-time employed at a fast food outlet can't afford $83.33 a month for a brand new $100,000 home, you see. So the cost of these plagiarists, and who is Paul Grignion, for instance, you know, who's produced this money as debt ditty? He's nothing but an artist. I shouldn't say nothing but an artist. He's an artist, an acrylic artist, you know, who dabbles in video work. So he's taken the work of other people and he's drawn a conclusion from it that debt is the issue and that money cannot be issued as a debt, which basically all of my plagiarists are taking that side of the issue, which is wrong, which is good in truth because it's easy to hammer out who's on the wrong side of this. These people are all doing this for money. And fame and glory and whatever. And it's false glory because it isn't even due them. They didn't recognize what the problem is. When I was doing this, through the 1970s, formally published many places since 1975 on, I argued against everyone. No one, people just scoffed at the idea that interest was terminal. I mean, the math was right and everything, but then they would say, well, who's going to loan us money if it isn't subject to interest? It isn't the issue that we're being loaned money. We only think we're loaned money because we buy into the deception, and the deception is preposterous when you unravel it. You see, the banks don't give up this money. They just, from a license to issue money, that's what's been done. This lie has been perpetrated and it's terminal.
Well, it's great, you know, a perfect lie. I can lie as much as I want, and I can even print my lie into existence or just make it up on a computer and control the entire economy. Isn't that fabulous? You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know the way it's going to go.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, broadcasting live from the future, live around the world on AM and FM affiliates, and also the listeners on the internet streams as well. My very special guest, Mike Montagna, is talking about the mathematically perfect economy. And so far we've had Money as Debt, the documentary film, and I believe there was also a book that it was based on, actually came out of his ideas. And have you received credit for that, by the way?
Oh, no. No, in fact.
Of course.
No, but the truth of the matter is, you know, I'm 10 years before even there was a formal internet. You know, my work was the only monetary reform presence. And then everybody that cropped up, you know, 3 or 4 years after, you know, the original advent of the formal internet, which is, you know, approximately 1993, where HTTP, you know, and markup language were introduced and started seeing general usage in the first, what we call web pages, you know. Even in the first days, we didn't even have domains generally. We might put up a personal website, and that's what several of my first sites were. But my work was the only work that proved this, and no one precedes me in history. In fact, most of the plagiarists now, and you name all of the top ones, you know, Richard Cook, Stephen Zarlinga, Jock Jacaran, you know, Money is Debt, Paul Greenone, you know, all of them have made blatant flaws in their assertions, which are wholly inconsistent with the deductions that you make to determine what's the problem and what's the solution. One of my greatest fans, and the reason that these people don't credit me, of course, is when you are a plagiarist, the last person you can mention exists is the one you're stealing from, the one that all these ideas come from. You know, I mean, just to give you an example, Stephen Zarlinga, you know, comes out with a book, The Lost Science of Money. And he writes me because evidently he collected my email address while he was going around promoting himself and or getting ready to promote himself. And he writes me in this first wave of promotion, and he says, he writes me basically, he says that we're of like mind, and he asked me to help him promote his book, The Lost Science of Money. And I see this title, The Lost Science of Money, and, you know, I mean, no one in the world, I mean, I studied thousands of years of history. You know, nobody, you know, I mean, scripture teaches, you know, not to practice usury, but, you know, religion has gotten away with, supporting the idea that some rates of interest aren't usurious somehow. You know, and I wrote a paper in the early 70s, you know, interest is usury. And that paper has been plagiarized by, just hundreds of people, if not thousands of people, possibly hundreds of thousands of, I can't even keep track of it anymore. It's ridiculous how much of every day is taken up with a new plagiarist, a new initiative, you know. But anyway, Zarlinga writes me, you know, saying we're of like mind, and that, you know, asking me to help him promote his book, Lost Science of Money. And I'm thinking, you know, where was this guy 30 years ago? You know, 35 years ago, you know, he wasn't on my side. Now he's seen my website, and he's just, you know, all these people just decide that they can say it better or something. And if you read their work, it's preposterous, the errors that they make. They can't even articulate, you know, the fundamental problems, much less the implementation of solution as it accounts for all things. I mean, ask any of these other people, just for instance, all right, well, how would you finance gold under mathematically perfected economy? At a political movement. Mm-hmm. And they asked me that question. They said, you know, we've been looking at your web pages, and we're convinced you're the only answer. And yet there's a couple of really bright people in our organization. And would it be okay if they asked you some questions? And I said, absolutely. And we had a recorded interview just like this, and they asked me, you know, how would you finance gold? And you can go to TNS Radio and read, listen to my program archives and listen to me answer this question live. You know, ask that question live to Stephen Zarlinga, Ellen Hardson Brown, Bill Still, Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich, anyone. Ask them. See if they've got an answer. You'll hear nothing.
Indeed, Dennis Kucinich voted in favor of Obamacare as well, which is unconstitutional at the very least. So it's like when you look at these political leaders and posturing and all of that, I mean, very few of us have any hope, really, because it's like the bad barrel is so big that it doesn't matter how good the apple you throw into it.
Well, you know, I mean, it's funny, and I hope I'm not perceived as trying to promote myself. The last thing that I think, according to all my values, the idea of being a president, you know, is preposterous. But, you know, in truth, in each and every country of the world, if we're going to resolve this issue, what we need is a leader who understands the problem and took it upon himself or herself to resolve it. Where are they? Back in the day when, you know, freedom was finally manifested in the form of government that serves and preserves freedom, which is a republic, not a democracy, a republic. When it finally manifested in the republican form of government all across the world, what do we have? We have
A very nuts system, in the least. What I'm getting at is I wanted to sort of put down and define the economy itself. I mean, when we talk about the issuance of currency, the issuance of credit, the private central banks that we've got here. I mean, this is sort of a side issue because the economy, of course, is being run by these people. But they're using a doctrine that's basically, well, at the very least, incorrect, and at the very most, quite tyrannical and engaging in copious quantities of fraud.
Well, now, of course, that's true. But what I'm getting at is like, you know, where does our leadership base come from? What do we look? What do we even call leadership? And what do we consider to be something which can resolve our issues? You know, it's like, for instance, let's just put it into context here. We have George Washington, you know, commands the revolution and we prevail in the revolution. Who do we elect as our first president under the Constitution? We had several, I think it was 9 presidents under the Articles of Confederation prior to that. But we don't look somewhere else for our leadership base. You don't look to plagiarism for solution of the issues. You don't look to pretended authorities for solution. You have to understand what solution is. This is why all of this has to be addressed now. And that's that. But, you know, when I speak in public about these things, people, you know, ask me to run for president. They demand it, you know. I'm not going to do that. I would serve if I was so elected, but, you know, I'm not a dreamer. That's not about to happen the way things are going. And the thing that has to happen if the people are going to save themselves from terminal monetary failure is they have to realize what the cause of their problems are and what the solution is. And I've been telling you, I've never changed. 43 years, it's been the same story. So that's what has to happen. You know, people have to wake up and realize what solution is, or we don't have a chance. And that's about
all. Let's talk about step one. I mean, phase B is getting to a mathematically perfect economy. All right, we're currently in phase one. But what's the first step that we need to take? I mean, what kind of laws need to be repealed or instituted in order to bring it about?
Well, I have years and years and years in engineering those laws, and I've authored a mandate for what I call mathematically perfected economy and absolute consensual representation. And that mandate is the changes in the laws. Just for example, there are so many things wrong with the way that the laws are made. One thing, if we're going to perfect our government, we have to understand that a law that's imperfect cannot stand with its imperfections above any individual recognizes, because each and every one of us, regardless of a majority, have a right to not have any crimes committed against us. And just for example, when this Federal Reserve Act was imposed upon the people in the 1912 Democrat elections, Democrat Party, the Republicans proposed creation of a central bank, which could only cause the very problems it promised to solve. The Democrats were elected into power. Immediately, the authors of the Aldrich Bill, which proposed a central bank, were in the Wilson administration, revising it under a different name, Federal Reserve Act. It's not federal. It's 12 private corporations. The Democrat Party had promised explicitly not to create a central bank. And so we had a breach of power, a breaking of a promise, and this is how we get this bank. President Wilson realizes years down the road that it's a
he was scammed.
Yes.
He says, "I am a most unhappy man. I've unwittingly destroyed my country by giving the control of its currency
exactly.
to overseas bankers."
And he also made a lot of statements to the effect that
there was a conspiracy involved and nobody would speak of it above their breath for fear of the repercussions.
Right. You know? And in other words, he was fearful himself.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing, though. If a citizen can stand up and disprove what's being proposed as solution, we all should recognize that. And that should, that understanding or perception should precipitate to the fore. And so what has to happen is this mandate, for instance, allows us, provides all the conduits for that. It prevents a law from being named anything but what it is exactly. That can be disproven. The name has to be rectified, or the law has to be rectified. And on and on and on and on. For instance, Reagan announced his presidential campaign in 1979, and he was going to decrease federal taxes 10% per year for 3 years, and that was supposedly going to balance the federal budget. And eliminate price inflation. Well, I called the Reagan campaign immediately and said, no. You know, absolutely not. And I provided mathematic proofs that that wouldn't happen. They took great interest in my work and, you know, and I was asked to provide, you know, written documentation of this thesis of inevitable failure and singular solution. So during the campaign, I even provided a prescription for immediately converting any of these false economies into mathematically perfected economy, not only immediately, but even without cost. And so the thing is, what do? We suffer 4 years under Reagan and then another 4 years under Reagan, and all of the things that I projected came true. And yet, if I'd been able to, if we had recognized these proofs ourselves and decided on that and the proofs of facts had prevailed, we wouldn't have suffered all these consequences.
Yeah, duh. Pay attention to facts and you won't get completely effed up by the economy. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Mike Montagna. We'll be right back.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man.
A group of international banksters. But they are, invariably. Right. Because if you have a look at campaign financing, and in New Zealand, a lot of it has to is actually still anonymous to my knowledge. And in the United States, take a look at like Barack Ochobarry versus John McSkeletor. Okay, they we're talking about like $500 million was given to Barack Obama's campaign by the same group of banks that gave $250 million to John McCain. Have you heard?
Sure.
Of hedging a bet, ladies and gentlemen. The banks select who rules you. You get to elect your dictator and you get to be happy about it because you participated in the process. That's it. Beyond
right.
That, you're electing your own enslavement, you know?
Choose your fate. Choose your doom.
I mean, it's like we're at the very end of the Ghostbusters movie where that big demon comes out from the other side of dimension and asks the Ghostbusters to choose the form of their destruction. That's what we do when we vote.
Right.
You know?
The only question is which...
Barack Obama is the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man of the American presidency.
Right. The only question is who's going to be the figurehead when it all comes down, and as it all comes down, which of course it is every day, a lot of people wouldn't ever realize that, for instance, you know, in the regular course of my work, I call every, you know, even remotely, possibly conducive candidates' campaigns, and you know, offer a proposition of mathematically perfected economy as a campaign platform. That proposition has been very well received many, many, many times by campaigns. In fact, the Obama campaign warmly embraced the idea, got me they wanted me to send it to the, I think it was just called their economic policy team in Chicago. Affirmed during our discussion several times that return receipt requested certified delivery was perfectly fine. And they returned that economic policy team, and it isn't a difficult matter to turn up who was involved in it. But they returned my proposition unopened. Now, how does that happen when you have the irrefutable arguments, the only ones which can't even be allowed to rise in a forum of debate where issues are resolved into what we have to understand about them. When you have no argument against mathematically perfected economy, basically they're affirming that they understand that indeed this obfuscation of the currency is terminal, that mathematically perfected economy is the only solution. It is the only thing that can save us from it, as I've, you know, written for since, you know, formally since 1979, you know. There's a simple means for immediately converting these systems into mathematically perfected economy, and that basically is little more than to refinance all our debts under mathematically perfected economy, counting all prior payments of interest instead toward principal, and then paying the remaining principal, if any, at the rate of consumption of the remaining value of the property. That alone would resolve most of the world's debt, because we've already paid it, most of it, many times over, and particularly government debt, which is, you know, a perpetual process of conversion of interest into, you know, further principal or debt in the wake of government overspending, which is basically the only thing that's actually keeping these false economies alive any longer either, because we can't afford, we've already exceeded our creditworthiness. The people, the private sector can't afford to borrow any further, as much as is necessary to maintain a vital circulation. And when that happens, what happens? In a month, you know, we pay all the money in circulation out of circulation with no way to restore it. You know, no way to sustain any industry at all ever afterward. No way to continue servicing our debt. You know, we're that close to immediate failure. And so we can't really, we can't mess around with this. I mean, people have to take this seriously. What is the possible damage of reducing your payments on your home to approximately, you know, 1/12 across the board? And, you know, most homes that are in foreclosure would instead be, you know, years ahead of payment, if not fully paid. I know someone who's, you know, paid $250,000 on a $93,000 property, and they're like, you know, 90,000 of the principal is paid off, and they're in arrears, and they're going to lose the whole thing. You know, what sense does that make? You know, to think that, oh, well, that sounds lofty, mathematically perfected economy. No, we couldn't solve inflation and deflation. No, we can't even understand the, you know, the obfuscation of the currency that we have to understand in order to understand that there's a solution for all
this. Yeah, it's like, know? It's so illogical that a totally made up fictional frickin' thing such as an economy that's a total abstraction of thought couldn't be actually fixed with thoughts itself.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, and that there's no math to it, or that there's a math that justifies the obfuscation of the currency. Where is it? Look through all history. There isn't an argument. There, you know, in fact, when Wilson responded to arguments by Colonel House, for instance, he regularly cited the obvious opposite of the truth, which any person who isn't gullible would have seen through immediately. There isn't any conclusive argument that justifies a Federal Reserve System. All this was about exploitation from its first day. And all through history, every time one of these systems has risen up somewhere, it's been for the to achieve the objects of exploiters. It is, you know, there's nothing sophisticated about it. It's basically such a preposterous deception that people who live under it have a hard time realizing that, you know, it isn't right at all, you know.
Let's just get this straight. The reason why the economy is so massively effed up at this particular point is because, basically, the economy was thought up by a whole bunch of liars. And they've lied so much that everybody believed the lies to be the truth, and they think that the economy is supposed to be working, but that's a lie, therefore the economy is not working. Is that about right?
basically just about any preposterous thing you could think, they get away with. And meanwhile, you know, the people who are plagiarizing solution are splintering all the people who have a chance of understanding from understanding. I mean, I did, you know, my program last week on, you know, TNS Radio. You can read the archive at tnsradio.com or listen to them all, you know, all my programs. Last week we're dealing with this money is debt thing. So, you know, people, you know, don't understand what it is with this plagiarism thing. They think that people are helping by taking what was originally my work. And, you know, you remember that game you played when you were children. You sat around in a circle and the first person would whisper something to someone to one side of them, and it would go around the circle and come back to you, and it wouldn't be anything like what, you know, had originally been said. And this is what's going on here. Well, what right do these people have to change it, you know, when they're not even a credible authority? You know, I mean, we say we have a right to opinions, and indeed we do, but we also have an obligation to make our opinions correct. You see, we also have intellectual property rights and all these other things. I mean, you know, if people think that the internet is just some license to steal now, and that isn't good. You know, one true story was what we needed. And when we take that, deviate it from it, compromise it, obfuscate it ourselves to claim some glory and or to make a pile of money off it somehow or something, you know, just, I mean, I'm sorry. That's at least as enmical as the bankers, you know, the usurers, the money changers. You know, you have basically this video, money as debt, claiming that debt's the issue, not interest. You see, it's this obfuscation of the currency that launders what is a debt, but it's not a debt as we understand it. It's an obligation to pay principal, to pay and retire principal from circulation.
Well, and they didn't even have that kind of worth or value or anything in the first place. It's just like you come in and you put your signature on a piece of paper and all of a sudden they're rich and they can just give you all this money, which you have to pay off for like the rest of your life. You know, that's basically what they're doing. It's just total fraud. And, well, thank you very much, Mike, for coming on the show with us today. Unfortunately, it is just about that time. So if you have a quick website or something like that you'd like to rattle off, go for your life.
Well, the new site where we're going to make this, we're going to host a worldwide initiative. We're still looking for a host, and the website has to go up, but that will be perfecteconomy.org. People who want to view my work can see it at perfecteconomy.com, but probably the best thing to do would be to visit my radio program archive.